from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Ollie.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And as usual, it's great to be with you. Professor Dolores Cahill, a professor of translational science at the University College Dublin, prestigious UCD, will be on the programme in the second hour. I don't think I need to tell you too much about Dolores Cahill now. We'll get into that a bit later on. Looking forward to connecting with her. Before that, the author, philosopher and jazz legend Gilad Atzmon will be on to discuss the new hate crime bill, which could see people prosecuted for things they've said in their home. We'll also talk about identity politics and how identity politics is shaping our response to the arbitrary lockdown measures. There you are. And as usual, you can participate by, well, by sending me a tweet. Are you well? I'm not great now. I'm not great at all. Swallowing is even more painful than it has been yesterday. And I can't even sneeze now without excruciating pain in my throat. But I'm with you. I'm with you anyway. As the Senate Judiciary Committee is in session in DC, you might be aware of this. Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey of Facebook and Twitter, respectively, are taking questions on US election coverage, censorship and all of that. Lindsey Graham is the chairman there. That's all going on now. I think it's interesting. We might get into some of it tomorrow. No more YouTube uploads for the Richie Allen Radio Show. I hope you'll understand. The platform has been deleting lots of content, not just my content, but other people's content as well. And I uploaded the interview with Dr. Vernon Coleman yesterday, and I think it was deleted in about 4 minutes. And I was told I wouldn't be then able to upload for a week, but I won't be uploading ever again. And please don't waste my time by mentioning BitChute or Brand New Tube. I'm not interested in alternative video platforms. It's a radio show that's live right now, and then it goes on to podcast, iTunes and Spotify. If you can't manage to listen to it that way, you're a muppet and I have no time for you anyway. Do you understand? So YouTube is gone. I'll leave the channel there and that's fine, but I won't be uploading to it again. By the way, speaking of the great Dr. Vernon Coleman, he made a mistake yesterday when quoting the Moderna white paper on RNA and DNA vaccines from back in 2017. Vernon said, and he has acknowledged, because he's quite the gentleman, you know, he said, the fact is the mRNA vaccine is not a DNA vaccine, so it isn't known, it is not known to change the recipient's DNA. I am mortified I made an error, says Dr. Vernon Coleman. I could wriggle, but it isn't my style. Apologies, Rich, he said. No need to apologise at all. Everybody makes a mistake. Doesn't matter how intelligent you are. The future Mrs. Allen alerted me to this last night after the programme. I didn't notice it. Vernon wasn't misleading. He knew you'd look at the paper, and I would. He's a genius, but he isn't infallible. We all make mistakes. No big deal whatsoever. Apple products worth 5 million quid were stolen from a lorry on the M1. Did you hear this today? 5 million quid. The driver was tied up. Travellers, no doubt, will be going door to door in Salford this week with great deals on iPhones and, of course, on iPads.
You junkies bastard, yeah. You junkies bastard, yeah.
I know. It's an absolute, it's a racist stereotype. I shouldn't have said it. And I'm scared of the travellers, to quote the great Tommy Tiernan. They'll be after me now. That's a joke, of course. Listen, travel rules have been relaxed for people arriving in England to work on poultry farms. Right? The government is concerned that we won't have enough turkey available for Christmas dinners. So they have relaxed the rules for people arriving in England to work on poultry farms. Because the virus, of course, well, the virus just won't mind, you know.
What kind of fuckery is this?
The virus will understand. Yeah, they need to get these people in to pluck the turkeys and to, I don't know what they do, pack the turkeys and freeze them and get them into the supermarket. So the virus understands and will stand down. COVID is going to stand down. Jesus, Mary, and Holy Saint Joseph. Big news on Sky News this afternoon. Did you hear this? 4 o'clock. It is now 8 minutes past five. This was the opening story, the lead story on Sky News this afternoon at a minute past four. Have a listen.
Hello, good afternoon. We start with some breaking news, and Sky News has learned that chief constables have been told to immediately stop issuing £10,000 fines to those who break coronavirus restrictions. It comes after concerns were raised that the fixed penalty could be challenged in court.
Wow. Constables, chief constables have said stop issuing £10,000 fines for illegal gatherings because they could be challenged in court. Delighted to say that Piers Corbyn, our pal, who has received several of these fines, totalling £3.7 million, is on the line from London. Piers, you must be delighted. Piers, we'll come back to you, Piers, when you've calmed down. Here's Sky News correspondent Mark White with more.
Effectively, what's happening is that those who are being issued with this fixed penalty notice for 10,000, a significant number of these people are perfectly understandably deciding that they want to appeal this very hefty fine. Now, in appealing it, it goes through the court process. And then, of course, it's up to a magistrate in court looking at all of the issues here, a defendant, their background, their means, how much income they have coming in, etc., can decide that £10,000 of a fixed penalty is just too much for this person to pay, and either reduce the fine or give them a longer period of time in which to pay that £10,000 fine. So clearly pretty embarrassing for the government. The reason that this fixed penalty notice of up to £10,000 was introduced in the first place was to give the police more powers to tackle what was a growing and still is an emerging problem during lockdown, which is these organised events, mass gatherings, raves and other street and parties that are taking place with people of more than 30 in number gathering. It gives the police then an option to hand out pretty hefty fines for those organisers as a means of deterring them from doing that kind of activity. But now, it seems that certainly according to the National Police Chiefs Council, it's not at all clear the way in which this fixed penalty notice system is operating. So they're saying suspend it, don't issue any more fixed penalties. You can still go through the process, but you have to do it by means of a court summons instead.
Yeah, I think the truth is they know that when it gets to court, it'll be thrown out. When they get to court and a magistrate is faced with a man or a woman who was fined £10,000, it'll be thrown out. Why? Well, because it was imposed arbitrarily. Piers Corbyn got fined, while Extinction Rebellion people were not fined, while Black Lives Matter people were not fined. Speaking of Piers Corbyn, let's see if Piers has recovered. Piers, your reaction to no more £10,000 fines, Piers Corbyn. Piers. Grow up. Piers Corbyn, we're not going to get much out of him. I think we'll just move on. More than 2 million people are to be placed under Scotland's toughest COVID lockdown restrictions from Friday. Did you hear this today? The move will see level 4 rules imposed. Level 4 rules, Jesus. In 11 council areas across western and central Scotland, including Glasgow. Meaning non-essential shops, pubs, restaurants and gyms will have to close. Although schools will remain open, these restrictions will remain in place until December the 11th. Here's Jimmy Cranky today.
So except for some very limited purposes, including childcare or caring for someone who is vulnerable, exercise or shopping for essential goods, people living in level 4 areas should not be going out and about over this 3-week period. I know this will be tough This pandemic is having an impact on mental health for most, if not all of us. If you need someone to talk to, you can find out what support is available at clearyourhead.scot or by calling NHS 111. But also please remember this. Our objective in taking this action now is to protect the NHS, create the prospect of seeing some loved ones at Christmas and completing the journey to next spring with as few restrictions as possible and with the minimum impact on life and health.
Right. Okay. Cranky, if you're having a mental breakdown because you can't hug your grandmother or your mother in a care home, or you haven't seen your son or daughter for a while, or your business is going down the toilet, Cranky, what was that website again if you're going Section 8 in Scotland?
If you need someone to talk to, you can find out what support is available at clearyourhead.scot.
Clearyourhead.scot.
What kind of fuckery are you?
That'll make it all better. You're absolutely screwed to the wall. You've not got £200 in the bank because of this nonsense. Go to clearyourhead.scot and you'll be okay. Did you hear Matt Hancock speaking yesterday at the COVID briefing at number 10 Downing Street? Did you hear him? He was doing it because Boris Johnson is in isolation again. Hancock said some interesting things. He didn't, but have a listen anyway.
We can see the candle of hope, and we must do all that we can to nurture its flame.
What's that again? That's lovely.
We can see the candle of hope, and we must do all that we can to nurture its flame.
If anybody was begging for a hiding, it's Matt Hancock, isn't it?
But we're not there yet. Until the science can make us safe.
Until the science can make us safe. Until the science.
Until the science can make us safe.
Make us safe.
We must remain vigilant and keep following the rules that we know can keep this virus under control.
Under control. I've been tripping over face masks on my travels around Salford. Have you? They're everywhere. They are. Everywhere. Face masks. Discarded face masks. Full of COVID germs. Allegedly. They're all over the streets, the highways and the byways of Salford. And apparently, most cities, most boroughs in the UK. BBC Radio 2 journalist. Yeah. Jeremy Vine is all over it.
So have you noticed face mask litter where you live? Maybe they're in the hedgerows, the parks, the streets. There's no doubt that those disposable blue masks have become an unsightly and potentially hazardous hallmark of this pandemic. As well as making a mess in our open spaces, discarded face masks also risk harming wild animals and pets who become tangled in them, mistakenly eaten them, whatever. So you may have seen face mask litter where you live and you're sick of it, or you've stepped in to tell somebody, oi, don't drop your disposable mask on the ground. Or maybe your dog has tried to eat one.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he was inundated with calls. Even clergy phoned in. Here's Cindy.
And the Reverend Cindy Kent, MBE, is on the Isle of Sheppey. What's happened to you, Reverend?
Good morning. Good afternoon, rather. We've got some lovely countryside here, really lovely walks, and it's horrible to walk around and see the face masks on the ground. It's awful to see the pictures in the newspapers of ducks and other animals that have got them tangled in as well. But the other thing, if I could just mention, is people not wearing them. And when you say something to somebody, you just get a mouthful of abuse.
Even if you're wearing your dog collar?
Yeah, actually, even if I'm wearing my dog collar, can you believe it?
What is this country coming to? That's terrible.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. But you point out to somebody that they've dropped something, and, you know, well, my son has actually said to me, please be careful, Mum, because, you know, you might just get somebody's fist or something, and so I do try and be careful. But you can't not say anything, can you? It's on a par with dog fouling, I think, to be honest.
Well, or the person who throws, I mean, I see this a lot. I see people throwing lit cigarettes into drain covers because there seems to have been some sort of message has gone round saying that they're ashtrays, and I don't know who put out that message, but obviously they're not. And it may be that people see the discarded, the old face mask as being like a crisp bag, and you just get rid of it.
Well, yeah, you shouldn't drop the crisp bag on the
table.
No. They should do. Let's find a bin and put it in. At the very least, do that. And if you don't take it home and dispose of it in a more sensible way. It's just a case of thinking of your... I mean, it's very Christian, isn't it? Love your neighbour. It's thinking of other people. It's helping other people not to get infected with anything that might be on the inside of your mask. And somebody else has got to pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, don't go around just leaving stuff all over the place.
Yeah. The world went tits up when they started ordaining women, didn't it? Women! Know your limits. Of course, Church of England, I think, has always had women reverends, women ministers, is that right? That would be an ecumenical matter. My knowledge of churches and the history of churches and how churches operate is very limited, now it must be said. Shorter news roundup. Going to get Gilad Atzmon on the programme after we hear from a tune. But before we do that, never forget this. You see? Something always goes wrong. It just went wrong. Right, let's play some music. Here's Hot Chocolate. Back in a moment with Gilad Atzmon. Jesus, that's loud. And Professor Dolores Cahill will join the programme in hour two. It's Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. The 17th of November 2020 from Planet Dystopia. Welcome. Hot chocolate, so you win again on Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show, which is live from Salford. All right, then, just before we get Gilad on the line, let's try one more time Piers Corbyn, just for the crack. Piers, £10,000 fines, no more of them, according to Chief Constables Piers Corbyn. Not going to get any sense out of Piers Corbyn today. He's no good whatsoever. Right, let's get Gilad Atzmon live on the line then. I don't need to tell you too much about him. Jazz saxophonist extraordinaire, philosopher, and the author of several brilliant books, including Being in Time, the definitive book on identity politics. As far as I've read or come across anyway. We're going to get into identity politics and how it has framed our response. By our, I mean ordinary men and women. Our response to the COVID-19 measures that have been imposed upon us and that have caused us the problems that it has caused us. It's caused us huge problems, of course, in terms of employment, in terms of money, but also mental health. And we could be here all day long. You know exactly what's going on. Here's an article from the Daily Mail last week, covered by everybody, about the Law Commission. A lot of talk about this in the last couple of weeks. Could heated talk over the dinner table become a hate crime? Lawyers called for offence to be extended to private dwellings, meaning conversations at home could spark police probes and prison sentences. This isn't a joke now, and it isn't one of those exaggerated things. This is being looked into. The government has given up on this and has passed this on to the Law Commission, and the Law Commission proposal will eventually become law. There will be very little, if any, opposition to this. New hate speech laws, criminalising speech, which will be extended to the home, despite pleas from people like Harry Miller, the founder of Fair Cop and others. Very serious. Let's welcome back to the programme to discuss this and other things the one and only Gilad Atzmon. Gilad, welcome back. How are you doing?
Hey, man. I'm very happy to hear your voice. And you're right. It is very disturbing, but not very surprising. We have been seeing it coming along. I'm not surprised, and I'm sure that you are not, and I even believe that most of your listeners aren't that shocked by this development.
Before we get into it, I should start off by saying, of course, you're a successful working musician, and most notably, recent times playing with the legendary Blockheads, and you'll be in touch with groups, musicians, you know, orchestra players up and down the country. What effect on entertainment, on the industry, has the lockdowns, I should say lockdowns, plural, what effect has it, Gilad, how serious has it been for entertainment, for culture?
I believe that it's not just in Britain, it's every country in the West. Music is basically live music, to be more accurate, is basically a nostalgic topic. It just doesn't exist. I, in the last 2 months, performed two big concerts, and as you probably remember, I used to do 5 of those a week for the last 25-30 years. And each concert is a struggle. You know, I played in Ronnie Scott in the end of August, a tribute to Charlie Parker, and until the gig was over, I wasn't sure that it was going to happen, because you know, we are all the time in kind of threat of lockdowns and so on and so on. And a few days ago, I played in Germany in a festival. It was a big theater, but kind of not a medium-sized theater, I should say, 400, 500 seaters. We were only allowed 70 people into the room. It was so strict that I couldn't even bring a friend because this would bring it to 71 and could jeopardize the future activity of this theater. I played on Saturday. The lockdown started on Monday, so kind of it was a lucky escape, but I couldn't fly home because all the flights were canceled. So even when you make a gig, it is such a complicated logistics that you really start to think twice whether you really want to engage in such an activity.
And when you came back from Germany, were you subject to quarantine?
No, because I didn't come back to Britain, but I didn't fly back to Britain. But my band at the moment is kind of made of people from we are from four different countries. We are from Britain, from Italy, from Germany. And I'm kind of, since the lockdown, I decided not to be in Britain, and it was a very clever decision. So I'm at the moment in Greece. And our British musician actually decided not to do the gig because he was afraid that he would be subject to quarantine. So it is really, really impossible to engage in this kind of activity. They basically killed the music, what was left out of the music business.
Do you think it's
completely.
Do you think it's terminal? Because I read the press just like you do, and while we don't believe everything we read in the press, I do believe it when they tell me that venues are going to the wall, theatres are going up the Swanee, and that it's unlikely that many of them will ever be able to recover from this.
I think that this is a correct reading. And when it comes to musicians, I believe that many of us won't return to this business. Now, you know, live music is just part of the business. I myself do a lot of work here. I write a lot of music. I do kind of studio work. But for a lot of musicians, the situation is grim. Many of them are literally starving at the moment. It is pretty devastating to watch. And I don't want even to start to talk about clubs, for instance, and theaters who have to pay, rents and local taxes and so on and so on, and they are in a horrendous situation.
Right, let's move on. Let's talk about proposed changes to hate crime and hate speech. This, you said yourself a few moments ago, this has been in the making for a long time. There hasn't or isn't anyway. There is opposition. There is opposition amongst the masses, amongst the great unwashed. But when it comes to politicians and when it comes to the media, there's little or no opposition. You can read the Spectator. You might read Spiked online, and you might see an opinion piece in the Telegraph. But those aside, and those are few and far between, everybody thinks that it's a good idea now that we protect so-called vulnerable groups, ethnic minorities.
I usually have a lot to say about those kind of things. Let me first be sarcastic, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Just to entertain you a bit. So the first thing that comes to mind is that this is how the left fights immigration. It makes the homeland indisputably unattractive. So we can talk about America, we can talk about Britain. If people used to immigrate to America because it was at one point the land of the free, It isn't the land of the free anymore. England, Britain, was so famous for its debate clubs, Oxford debate, its ability to entertain itself in radical intellectual discussion. It is now a nation of book burners. And book burning is now institutional. It is so severe that we even start to silence speech on the dinner table, and this is exactly what we are dealing with at the moment.
By the way, that's the funniest thing I've heard in months. And when you said this to me earlier on, I laughed for 20 minutes.
Now it goes farther, you know.
Can I repeat that? Just before you carry on uninterrupted? I've got to repeat that because it's the funniest thing I've heard for ages. The left is so devious that it chooses to fight immigration by making the country a complete basket case of an authoritarian state to discourage migrants from coming in. It's the funniest thing, man.
But I think that this can go farther because, you know, there is nothing I can do about it. I'm an ex-Jew. So I still kind of sometimes think, you know, in very commercial manner, I used to know how to turn things into business. And I think that we have a great, great, great opportunity now to start to develop, I would call it Orwellian tourism, you know, to bring people to the country and show them, you see, in the past, you know, it used to be a free country. Look, you take them, you show them the cameras in the streets. We can show them the Google building near Queen's Cross. There is a lot of new tourist landmarks that we can develop, and we can even torture them a bit.
So if you read 1984 in school in Somalia, come to England and experience it for a week. I love it.
Yeah, it's because at the end of the day, you know, when we learn 1984, it's kind of a Russia model. No, but when you read 1984, it is all about London, about England. And the most amazing thing, and we discussed it in the past, is the fact that Orwell saw it coming. Yeah. How could Orwell see it coming in 1948? This is when he wrote it. And I argue in Being in Time that he saw it all because he fought with the Trotskyite militia in the 1936 Spanish Civil War.
Yeah.
And he basically fought alongside the International Brigade that was a lefty setting, and we know what happened in this war. It was so bad that eventually the local Spanish left begged them to leave because they caused so much damage. There was all this internal fight. They were burning each other books, each other texts, fighting each other. And this is exactly the identitarian wars that we see nowadays on a huge scale. You know, when it comes to America is just one step before a civil war, and maybe as we are talking, it already started. You know, last Saturday it looked quite grim in Washington.
Yeah. By the way, if anybody wonders, there will be, somebody might say, whatever happened to that Gilad Atzmon guy? He used to be a saxophone player with the blockade.
I'm still a saxophone player.
This is in the post live music world. So when all of that is gone, he'll be running Atzmon 1984 authoritarian tours. So you can go from free parts of the world, you can come to England and be tortured and see what it's like here. That was brilliant. I mean, you're absolutely bang on. I see what's happening in America as well. And what I wanted to ask you about, we're going to go till 6 o'clock, folks. We've got 25 minutes now with Gilad, and I don't want to be interrupting him too much. What I wanted to ask you, because you're talking about identity politics, hasn't human civilization, we've succumbed to identity politics. And in doing that, we've made it very easy for the architects of things like the COVID-19 lockdown totalitarian nightmare that we're envisaging now. And I don't want to be very simplistic about this, but I think sometimes you can be a bit simplistic. While we've gotten, and again, you mentioned Being in Time, nobody could call me a sycophant. Being in Time is one of the most important books I've read in the last decade. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's a fantastic read. It's very important. It's easy to read. It's funny at times. It's sharp. It's right on the money. We have succumbed to it. We've succumbed to, you know, right versus left, Christian versus Muslim, Muslim versus Jew, socialist versus conservative. And while we've done that, and we've actually subbed it, and you've talked about this, I've heard you on other programs, even more eloquently speaking about this, we've subdivided now where we're now gone down to non-binary people against straight people, against trans people. And because of that, I would say, very simplistically, it's made it exceedingly easy for the nightmare that we're looking at today, where Nicola Sturgeon is saying, if you're living in Glasgow and you want to go 5 or 6 miles outside of the city, you'll be arrested if you don't have a good reason for it. Identity politics has brought us to this. Tony Soprano once said in The Sopranos, it's one of the funniest lines ever, he said, conolinguist, he said, and something else has brought us to this. I would say where we are now, identity politics has brought us to where we are now. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. And we already spoke before on this program about identity politics, and I'll make a very, very simple illustration of the situation or the shift that we saw in our society. It's very, 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 very simple. Initially, the left ideology was a unifying idea. It used to tell us, and I remember it myself, you know, it's not that many years ago. They used to tell us, it doesn't matter if you are a man or a woman, a Jew, black, Muslim, English, we are all united as working people against those bad guys in the city, against the capitalists, and so on and so on. At a certain stage, the left went through a serious shift, and they start to teach us to speak as a woman, as a gay, as a Jew, as a trans, as an Arab, as a black, and so on and so on.
As a trade unionist and so on,
And now the idea was to break us into segments, and instead of fighting capitalism, we are fighting each other. And who are the people that are funding this lunacy? And you see it nowadays, this week, last week, more than ever. Wall Street, the rich. Because instead of fighting capitalism, or let's say global capitalism, we are fighting each other. The black are fighting with the white. The gays are fighting with the hetero. The women are fighting with the men. The Jews end up fighting everyone. And this situation is exactly what we saw in America, or if you want to talk about Britain, in Brexit or in the last election year. We see a battle between those who identify themselves as a, and this is a collective or an amalgam of the many different identities, who are fighting politically with those who identified as Brits or as Americans.
Yeah.
So those who identify as Americans, they actually vote for Trump, and some of them are black and some of them are Latino. For instance, we know that Trump or the Republican Party actually increased its share amongst the so-called diverse minorities. And why? While the left offers you at the moment to stay black forever, or to stay Latino forever, or to stay gay forever, if you want to be an ordinary American, to assimilate, so to say, into the society, all you have to do is to spend $1 or $2 to buy a Trump cup, this red silly thing, and you become an American. So it's Americans versus identitarians, Brits versus identitarians. And this is exactly why we see a bizarre moment in history. And I wrote about it in Being in Time. I kind of followed this shift in society for quite a while, where the working class end up supporting a right-wing billionaire And the left is becoming the voice of the middle class, and it is supported by the by Wall Street or by money tycoons. This is a very bizarre situation, but it is not new. If we look at it historically, we understand, and now only now I can answer your question, we see that the left is very frustrated by the fact, always has always been frustrated by the fact that it is not getting the support it's supposed to get from the working class. And then they started to try to look for new oppressed, and this is where they invented the new oppressed are the gays, the women, the trans, and so on and so on. And they created their a power that is based on this political amalgam.
Can I ask you a question just to make sure? Can I ask you a question just to make sure I understand? I'm sorry for interrupting, because I like this. I think I get this. So the working class abandoned the left, particularly in the December general election here in the UK. They abandoned the left, they abandoned momentum.
They abandoned it here clearly in the Brexit.
No doubt. And they couldn't understand all this momentum, identity politics, bollocks about trans people and all of that. So they abandoned them. So the left needed new fertile ground. So it started to look for, as you said there, other groups that could be grouped together, people that could support it, people that it could act for, people that it could represent. So it
They invented new oppressed. It didn't start last year. It didn't start 2 years ago. It probably
20 years
ago. When we talk about the origin of this movement, in my research, it goes as far as the 30s with the Frankfurt School.
Does it?
The Frankfurt School was a group of Jewish and neo-Freudian and neo-Marxist intellectuals. They had to run away from Germany. And they started to spread their ideas from Columbia University in America. And eventually, those ideas came to Europe in the 60s. And this is pretty much the 68 revolution.
But so we only saw it here in the 90s, didn't we? We saw it here kind of around Blair after Blair. Once Kinnock had gone and John Smith had died. I wonder about John Smith dying, by the way. But after that, then the Blair regime came in. And I think you're right, the 60s for Europe. But we began to notice this, didn't we, in the late 90s?
Now, exactly. Now, I'm really interested in British humor. And I wasn't aware of them, but somebody sent me, you probably remember it, the two Ronnies.
Yeah, the two Ronnies, yeah.
King the Bell. Genius. So when I look at their work and I plan to write about it, they saw all of it. Now, you know, in America, they had Archie Bunker. All stays in the family. I don't know if Brits know it, but we in Britain, we had another, actually, I think that this was the original. It was Al Garnett.
Keep it in the family.
Yeah, so keep it in the family, and in America it was called All Stays in the Family. And these were the characters that push identity politics through TV. How did they do it? And I'm more familiar with Archie Bunker than with Al Garnett. But basically, every program, they would isolate, they would single out an identity, they would mock them or mock it or ridicule its cultural habits or whatever, and this would lead to people feel kind of that they have to organize in a sectarian or sectorial manner. And
so, are you saying that in the 1970s, then, when we had Leonard Rossiter, Rigsby, Rising Damp, when we had young black men being the butt of jokes in sitcoms, that was almost deliberately done, and it alienated young black men who then mobilized against that. Is that what you're saying?
I can tell you, I cannot talk about British history, the comedy history, because I'm not familiar enough with this.
I think you're onto something. I think you're onto something.
No, but I definitely did it in America. Definitely in America, and I actually showed how it was done through the American Al Garnett, which is all stays in the family, Archie Bunker. And I suggest that you go on YouTube. You know, whoever listens to us, and check out Archie Bunker, All Stays in the Family, and you can see it in every episode. And I looked into the people who were involved, and they were progressives with a very clear agenda. Now, you have to understand one, it is very important to mention, that the people, and maybe I'm wrong about it, maybe I'm naive. I wouldn't mind to be naive. I heard that it's a lot of fun. You know, you don't see a lot of things that you know that you're not supposed to see.
Yeah.
But I believe that it is not necessary that those who introduced us to identity politics were Machiavellians or sinister or they had a kind of conspiratorial or whatever. It is very possible that they saw, usually you come with this kind of devil advocate teasing question. It is very possible that they could see that black people are subject to institutional racism, and this is definitely the case still in Britain, and the women are not enjoying equal conditions and so on and so on. And their idea was to introduce equality. What really happened is that this has morphed into a devastating, violent reality that is about to destroy the universe as we know it. And it's not a secret. America is in a very dangerous, very volatile situation at the moment. And I would believe that Britain is pretty much the same situation, but it is not fully aware of its condition. And this is why it may be more vulnerable to some severe manipulation, and this kind of new legislation or potential legislation is one example. Now, I want to say a few things to move a bit beyond, actually, I would say, the identity politics, and to try to understand what is really happening here, because I think that there are a few other aspects that we must touch. First, the fantasy of freedom. We grew up in liberal democracy. We are more or less the same age. Maybe I'm a bit older than you. I don't know. We used to the idea that we were free people. But it is becoming clear now that this freedom was a facade. Why were we free? Because we were supposed to be free to maintain that kind of capitalism that we were living in. So we had to make decisions where we buy jeans that is made in Britain, in America, or in China. We had to decide where do we buy our next car or our next tool or our next saxophone and so on and so on. In the world in which we are living, freedom is gone. They are telling us we are going to have two vaccines. There is one Facebook. There is one Google. There is one Twitter, and most important, there is one Amazon. So our freedom or our thought of ourselves as free subject is not important at all anymore for them. Our role is to be consumers. Now, this is very interesting to discuss this topic this week, these days, in this month, because I believe that some of the people who like Trump very much is because they see Trump, whether it is true or not, I'm not trying to talk as a Trump supporter, because they see him as an anti-globalist, as a person who tried to bring war back to America. Whether he managed to do it, whether he worked on it, it's another question. This is how they seem, because they can, they want, when Trump came up with this slogan, let's make America great again, what they saw is America where they believed in themselves being free and where they believed in themselves being capable of making a living, supporting their families, which is something that doesn't exist anymore. Another issue that we have to look into when we discuss this kind of new legislation, they tell us basically that they are going to look at what we are saying under our roof, in our dinner, on our near, next to our dinner table, next
what
to
we're
our
thinking,
kids.
What we're thinking, what we think about things. Yeah.
What we are thinking. Now, you know, I don't have to explain how devastating, and we discuss kind of the Orwellian issue, but what they're basically telling us is, why do you have to sit near to your dinner table? Why do you have to, why do you need a party? Why is not Facebook good enough? Is not Twitter good enough? You can sit in front of your computer and communicate with everyone around the world. Don't sit near to your dinner table. Don't make a party. Don't socialize. Socialize on the cyberspace. And this is exactly where they can control, see whatever you say.
So that's
and
deliberate.
The algorithms
thing.
Will punish you on the spot.
So do you think that's deliberate? That's a deliberate policy.
I think that this is deliberate. This is exactly where they're pushing us, you know. Even Orwell, who was definitely, you know, the greatest prophet of the 20th century, couldn't see this coming. Now,
they want us to stop meeting physically and enjoying our physical company. They would prefer that me and you didn't have a bottle of red wine and talk about your career and chat and listen to some music. They'd rather that we communicated remotely and
of
online
course.
Forever.
I think that this is very clear to me.
Yeah.
And you know, our politicians, you know, you mentioned our politicians. Our politicians are basically tools. They are not in any control of the situation. They are there to sustain consumption. 30, 40 years ago, even Blair, you know, I think that some people will start to be nostalgic about Tony Blair. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
You know, even Tony Blair saw some commitment to bring work. Now, our politicians are not here to bring work, to build factories, to introduce. They are just there to sustain consumption.
Do you believe, sure, Gilad? Do you believe? We've got 7 minutes left, and I'm pissed off now that I didn't commit. No, not with you. That I didn't commit more time to this. So we're going to have to pick this up again in a longer segment, me and you. We'll do it before Christmas because it's very important. So in the 7 minutes we have left. So when you look at documents from Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum, and these are real documents, and they propose that in 10 years' time or 12 years' time or 15 years' time, is that nobody will own anything. All debt will be forgiven and everybody will be dependent 100% on the state. And this guy talks about merging our digital and our biological selves and all this. Is that where this is all going ultimately?
It's hard for me to say, because one thing that is very clear to me is that there is something that resembles a world government. How do I know? Because all our disasters are now global disasters. When I was a kid, there were no global disasters. My parents don't remember global disasters. We had war between countries, between few countries. We had local financial, you know, disasters. We had problem with our neighbors, but now every disaster that we have, whether it is pandemic, whether it is financial, whether it is climate, they're all global. And I guess that, you know, because we have one government, our all problems are kind of universal. But I think that nobody is yet capable, and I think that we will be able to do it soon, is capable. No one is capable to point out what exactly is there, what is this government, how it operates, who runs it, is it a person that run it, is it a spirit? These are very interesting questions, yeah. And they are largely philosophical. I would like to throw once again, you know, to encapsulate all those issues into these Athens and Jerusalem, because this is again the most crucial decision that every Western subject has to make. In my work, and it's not just in my work, I borrowed it from Leo Strauss and plenty of German philosophers, there is a distinction between Athens and Jerusalem. Athens is the place where we learn how to think. This is the birthplace of philosophy, of science, of Western music, Western aesthetics, Western ethics. This is where the place where we learn how to ask questions and to how to discuss those questions and those answers. We are more interested in the questions than in the answers. Jerusalem is the birthplace of revelation. In Jerusalem, we learn what to say, not how to ask, what to ask. We learn what to say, what is right and what is wrong. We don't learn how to think. We learn how to respond. Now, this is exactly what we see in the West. We started the West as an Athenian realm that was eventually battling with Jerusalem. Everything that we like about the West, freedom of speech, science, the poetic, the tragedy, the arts, these are all coming from Athens. Unfortunately, we are now under serious Jerusalemite invasion. And by saying Jerusalem, I don't mean Jews. I'm talking about the spirit of revelation. Even the idea of Marxism that I believe started as an Athenian instinct very quickly morphed into Jerusalemism. So instead of thinking like the Marxists should think in dialectic terms, they tell us what is right and what is wrong. Now, it is very easy, and it is very easy for a person who is inspired by Athens to show that every term that they are throwing on us, Jerusalemite, identitarians, is wrong. For instance, diversity. I just mentioned it like 20 minutes ago. Diversity, they talk about diversity. Diversity is the one thing that make it sure that you will never be able to assimilate. Because for a diversity to work, you have to retain your qualities. You have to stay black. You will never be English.
I hear you.
You will never, if you are Muslim, you will never be English because you have to celebrate your diversity. So in the name of anti-racism, and I'm anti-racist, we are actually sustaining racism. I'll give you another more devastating example.
Hey, just before you do, and that will be the final word because we've got 90 seconds left. Before you do that, every time I turn on the television now, I see advertisements featuring families where the couple, where the mum and the dad are mixed race or they're from a different ethnic background. I find it startling. And I'm too intelligent. I'm not the most intelligent guy on the block, but I'm too intelligent not to know that something is up. This is manipulation of one kind or another. I find it extraordinary. Even the Christmas ads now. Go ahead.
But this is the issue. If you are Athenian, you are not against mixed marriages.
Of course not.
Of course. We are not. The whole idea that this thing should become natural.
The normal.
Empathy, diversity. You know, when you learn how to think, you learn what is empathy. And empathy is exactly the thing that you stop thinking about diversity. And you love the other regardless of who the other is. And this is exactly what I miss from the left. And this is why Corbyn deserves every punishment because he was there to fight it and he was very quick to surrender to it.
Do me a favor, come back on the program and we'll talk. We'll talk Athens versus Jerusalem exclusively and we'll get into that. And I actually think I might know an academic who's a bit fond of you, but who will take a different point of view on it. And we could have a proper fireside conversation, I think, where we'd have plenty of time to talk about it.
I didn't realize that we still have academics in the UK.
We still have one or two. We still have one or two. Folks, if you haven't been to gilad.co.uk, go there and click on writings. Lots of articles written by this critical thinker, great analyst, as well as being a great musician. Gilad.co.uk. And the book Being in Time. I can't say enough times, please buy that book, read it and understand it, because a lot of what we were talking about today, you'll find it in the book, but explained in greater detail. Thanks, mate. Let's talk again just before Christmas for the crack.
Love you, mate.
Love you too. Speak real soon. The great Gilad Atzmon live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday. I love conversations like that. I hope you do too. It's a it's 1 minute past six. Here's The Clash. We'll play this for Piers Corbin. Yeah. Are you there, Piers? Music from The Clash, I Fought the Law on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Back real soon.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. The time is fast approaching 5 minutes past 6 o'clock. It is the 17th of November, 2020. Lovely to be with you today. Thanks for all the tweets. Great chat with Gilad Atzmon there. Remember, if you missed any of that, it'll be on Podomatic, it'll be on iTunes, and it'll be on Spotify a little bit later on. Not on YouTube anymore. The Richie Allen Radio Show will not be on YouTube anymore. Don't worry about that. It's not the end of the world. Okay, let's crack on then. Let's introduce my next guest. I'm really thrilled that she's agreed to come on the programme. Now, you'll know all about her by now if you've listened to this programme. She's a professor of translational science at the very prestigious University College in Dublin. And we learned about her back in April or May of this year when she began to get some bad press because she was asking some very significant, some very pertinent questions about the necessity of the lockdown. And she was asking questions about how serious coronavirus 19 was. Questions, of course, she was entitled to ask, but that doesn't matter these days. We saw the media backlash to that. And over the months, we've seen her appear at various protests, including at Trafalgar Square in London, where she addressed tens of thousands of people. She's been to Germany as well. Let's welcome to the programme Professor Dolores Cahill. I'm delighted that you're on the programme. Dolores, how are you?
I am delighted to be interviewed by you, Richie. Thank you for having me on. A pleasure.
It's an honour. And the first question, I've been thinking about this all day long. How does somebody like you, a woman of science and a woman of academia, you do your job, you're a researcher, you're a worker, you're diligent, you lecture your students, I'm sure you grade exams, and yeah, you're honest and you have integrity, and then all of this happens back in March, back in February, March, and you do an honest thing, you give an honest opinion on it. Did anything that came before in your professional life give you any idea that somebody of your standing could be attacked and denigrated in the way that you have been in the last 6 to 7 months?
I think that is unprecedented, but I suppose I would have been very aware that there are issues in science since 1999. And I'm very aware since the first SARS in 2002, 2003, that there are major issues. So I have actually been speaking, you know, aware of what's going on, aware when you try and fix it, it's quite difficult. But of course, the censorship and the media that has happened since I've spoken out in the last 6 or 7 months, I was aware that it happened to other professors like Professor Jordan Peterson, you know, and I have been standing up for free speech and academic freedom within the universities and around the world. So, but the newspapers and the way YouTube have taken off my videos and censored discussions of science and disease is unprecedented, Richie.
Speaking of that, Dr. Vernon Coleman insisted that I say hello to you today. He's
I am a huge fan of Dr. Vernon Coleman. Both of us are on Brand New Tube, which I'm supporting. And one of the reasons why I was very grateful when Brand New Tube, the founders, contacted me, because Dr. Vernon Coleman, who I admire hugely, was censored, you know, on YouTube, all of his videos. And he has a great sense of humor. And he would kind of say, I wonder how many days are the videos. And I cried, actually, when he said it was his last video for YouTube. And then I was delighted when Brand New Tube gave him a platform uncensored on Brand New Tube.
Yeah,
so
good.
My best wishes to Dr. Vernon Coleman. I admire him hugely. He's a hero.
Lovely. Yeah, he's a regular here, and he's mentioned you so many times. He's mentioned you so many times in the videos and all of that. So Professor Dolores Cahill is here. I don't know what to ask you, Dolores, really, that I haven't said to, you know, the other men and women that I've had on, whether it's been Martin Kulldorff or others. What's going on, Dolores? Why are we approaching Christmas, and are we being told that we might have, you know, increased lockdown measures that will take us to Christmas? Why are we being told that senior citizens in care homes can't see their grandchildren and their children, when even to a layperson like me, it's quite obvious that the virus isn't anywhere near as potent or as deadly as they told us it was, and that the vast majority of people will only have mild symptoms? What in your opinion is going on? I'm going to get out of your way because my audience has been dying to hear you and just listen to you. Tell us what's happening. We might have just lost Dolores momentarily there at that very important juncture. Oh, she's back. She's back in the room. After all of that, then we lost you for a moment. Dolores, what's going on?
No, did you lose me? I was just going to say, start off with the easy questions, Richard.
Yeah.
So very simply, I think I'll do it in plain English. There was no necessity for the lockdown ever, not ever. There was no need for it. This coronaviruses cause illness and symptoms between December and April. In the evidence that was shown from the CDC presented at the White House, there was a precipitous drop in people going to hospitals in America in the middle of April, which was exactly the way the normal coronaviruses work. It was the same all around the world. And if you do have illness and symptoms, vitamins D, C and zinc help. And then hydroxychloroquine and zinc. And there are other ones like ivermectin. So there is absolutely no need for any kind of societal measures. There is something that causes flu-like symptoms. There are treatments. No one need die. There's absolutely never was a reason for the lockdown.
Hydroxychloroquine has been particularly sensitive. It's been particularly controversial, hasn't it, since the President of the United States mentioned it, Donald Trump. And then I noticed there were some doctors, some real doctors, some men and women, very articulate men and women. They came out and spoke, I think, in Texas and said, we've treated people with it and it's worked. And they were absolutely hammered in the media, just as you were. And I spoke to one of them privately who wouldn't come on the program. And they said, well, Richie, the reason they're going after hydroxychloroquine is because it's very cheap. Do you go along with that?
So I think that is the narrative, right? So there are multiple narratives. And I think there's a lot of psychology going on with this and a lot of fear mongering. And the media, there's a certain story played out and the politicians and people are playing along. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity now, Richie, to say it. So really, hydroxychloroquine is one of the safest drugs in the world. It's on the World Health Organization Essential Medicine of the World list in 2017. So this is the WHO, you know. It has the lowest adverse event rate of nearly any medicine. It is FDA approved and European Medicines Agency approved. It's one of the safest drugs. It's used for malaria, lupus, and arthritis. So there, and it was known to, there was clinical trials after the first SARS in 2003 and 2005 and papers that hydroxychloroquine was working for coronaviruses.
And that's only three years ago.
So it's been around for, you know, 65 years, right? And it's on the World Health Organization Essential Medicine. And that means it can't run out. It's so essential that it's, you know, it's manufactured around the world and there was never any shortage. And it was known from China and around the world in 2020 to actually be very beneficial. And there was a survey in March of 20,000 doctors in 30 countries that were treating people with the symptoms of COVID-19, and hydroxychloroquine was known as the top one. This was in March, the survey was done.
Back in March.
And for treating. So you see, the issue is, if you have this wonderful essential medicine of the world to treat the symptoms of COVID-19, then you don't need any lockdown. So I think it's not that it's cheap. I think it's because it actually works.
Because it works. When back in the summer, we were looking back at the late spring here in the UK, and we talked quite a lot about how many senior citizens died in care homes. And yes, that's a disgrace. I'm not even going to get into that. There's no need to. Do you believe... Yep. Do you believe, Dolores, we've got Professor Dolores Cahill here. Dolores, do you believe that if hydroxychloroquine had been made available to the UK's care homes, that we might have avoided a lot of those deaths back then?
Yeah, but I think what's very simple, and I think what the good news for people listening is that actually we now know that for all kinds of influenza symptoms, that people can actually do something themselves to reduce any chance of them even getting symptoms. So you can actually take regular vitamin D, vitamin C and zinc, you know, that you can get from a pharmacist.
Yeah.
And in a preventative dose. So that will mean that in this thing, probably 90 people out of 100 won't even have any symptoms for coronavirus. And for the ones that have, they can, you know, boost their immune system. And then there's a preventative dose of hydroxychloroquine, which is just one tablet every 3 weeks because it has a half-life of every 3 weeks. And it's very safe. And it turns out the heart issue that was mentioned was not as, you know, was actually over emphasized, you know, the adverse events, because you can check for the heart. So I think the thing is, we have a prevention and a treatment. So Dr. Zelenko in March, you know, had looked at 799, mainly elderly people in New York, and he explained the symptoms. And then he gave them, when they started to have breathlessness, the preventative dose of hydroxychloroquine. And every single one, 799 of all those elderly people lived. They didn't go to hospital. He actually put the hydroxychloroquine tablets, you know, delivered them to their door, and zinc. And they all lived. And 20 of them, I think, went into hospital. So the thing is, there's actually a treatment that can save every lives. And this was already known in January, February, March. So really what I'm saying now is that every death from COVID-19, I've been saying it for some time, is a preventable death. There are preventions and treatments. And hydroxychloroquine works within 8 hours. And even if somebody has a fairly severe symptoms, if you just get three doses over 3 days of hydroxychloroquine and zinc, everybody, the breathlessness goes away and they're fine.
Dolores, if you are in the UK or Ireland now, and you are unwell, and you've got the breathlessness and all of that, should you or can you ask your doctor to prescribe you hydroxychloroquine? Is that possible?
Well, I mean, hydroxychloroquine is the safest, one of the safest drugs and essential medicine of the world. And it's always been prescribed, you know, all through 2020 for lupus and arthritis and for malaria.
So you'd insist.
World, you know?
So you'd insist. I mean, I'm somebody who suffers with the old bronchial stuff. Non-smoker, it must be said. I've always looked after myself. But if I got ill again and I said to my GP, I want it, I should be able to get it, shouldn't I?
So, I'm not a medical doctor, yeah, but I think, you know, it should be. So the question should be, because essentially we have a disease here that there is prevention and treatment. That's one of the safest drugs in the world. So the question should be, why are doctors making it available? And I know there was guidance from the, the company that manufactures it, and from various, medical organizations. For example, in Victoria, in Australia, a doctor will get 6 months in prison for prescribing it for COVID-19.
Is that
right? Doctors in the world are prescribing it for COVID-19 and for autoimmune diseases and malaria for 65 years, and it's so safe it can be given to pregnant women.
It's so safe it can be given to pregnant women.
So I suppose that is the real question. So I would be kind of saying to your listeners, instead of talking about, testing, is if it would be like if there was antibiotics were discovered, and then people were still dying of pneumonia, and the governments started, saying we will lock down the world because of pneumonia. But then everyone is saying, wait a minute, there's this treatment of antibiotics, and why are you not getting it? And antibiotics say they were made available for 10 years, and suddenly they started to say doctors will go to prison for prescribing antibiotics. And then at the same time, counting the number of deaths from a disease that could be prevented. So that is the real question.
That's the real question.
And as well as that, the media and the politicians and the medical people, they should be communicating that vitamin D, C and zinc are preventative. And there was a Nobel Prize for vitamin D and a Nobel Prize for vitamin C. And zinc is known to boost the immune system. And actually hydroxychloroquine on its own doesn't work. It's actually to get zinc into the cells because it prevents the replication of the virus. But another kind of thing I think should be hopeful for people is that coronaviruses only cause illness. They're seasonal. So some viruses, cause disease all year round, but coronaviruses only cause illness and symptoms between December and April. And that's why when you saw the red arrow of the peak around March, April in America, but then there was a precipitous drop. And actually in May and June, the number of people presenting with influenza-like symptoms across all of the United States, it's very well studied by the CDC, was the lowest in the previous 6 years. And if you look in across the entire United States, the people presenting in the 6 weeks between May and June for influenza-like illness is less than 100 people in 6 weeks. And that was at the time when there was a lockdown.
Now, let me ask you on that. That's important.
But do you know what I mean? That's really important.
Yeah.
So basically, nobody was presenting in the hospitals. I think like for some of those weeks, there were six people across 350 million people in the United States presenting in the hospitals with influenza-like illness in America, they recorded. So these people get immunity, and the viruses are not infectious for various environmental and sunlight and humidity. So I am saying they picked the wrong virus. Coronaviruses make people sick in March, April, and after that they're gone. And the reason why they're gone is that everyone in the world are immune. 90 people out of 100 won't have symptoms. They will never be negative any tests because their immune system in their nose, their mucosal immune system and their T-cell immune system is so rapid. And if they come across the coronavirus every day, they won't have symptoms. And then the virus itself weakens in every region. It only hangs around for about a month. It weakens, because you have errors in replication. And if there's an error, the virus can't replicate. And that's why they disappear. So that's why you're immune. You're recovered. There's absolutely no need for the lockdown. There never was. No need for masks. No need for social distancing. No need for PCR. No need for quarantining. And this will come out eventually. So this is all unnecessary. Truth will come out eventually, Richard.
You think the truth will come out? We'll talk about that in a moment. We've got Professor Dolores Cahill on the line. She's a biologist, a professor of translational science at the very prestigious University College, Dublin UCD, with an impeccable academic record, it must be said. And she's adamant that there was never any need for lockdown. And you talked there about December to April coronavirus.
Seasonal. Yeah.
I'm getting bombarded with tweets, literally hundreds of tweets coming in now with questions. Some of them are very good questions. We're being told by our collective media here in the UK that our hospitals are full at the moment of people presenting with coronavirus. Do you think, now it's been said to me by other academics and by other doctors, do you think that maybe what we're seeing now is seasonal flu? Is that what's happening in our accident and emergency, in our ICU at the moment? Regular flu?
So the thing is, if you look at all the textbooks, right, coronavirus is only caused illness and symptoms between December and April. But of course, you have a chart of all kinds. There's all kinds of other things that cause the symptoms of influenza. So if you look at these, what's been known for decades is that around this time, you have rhinoviruses can cause influenza-like illnesses. And you have some viruses that cause illnesses, influenza-like symptoms all year round. And then usually around December, the viruses will be influenza viruses, you know, from December and then all the way through until maybe again for influenza, April and May. So we have, but coronaviruses simply do not cause illness and symptoms, only December and April. That's it. They don't. So if people are presenting with influenza-like illness, you know, it could be a rhinovirus, it could be an influenza virus. And, you know, every year you get a different, there's different viruses that circulate. But really, last year's coronavirus, everyone is immune. And I think it's important to go back to how many people died. You know, that when they, the WHO declared a pandemic on the 11th of March, 2020, and everyone can search for it, it's pandemic declaration. And you would just say, how many people died in the world from this, you know, coronavirus that they were calling the pandemic? And the numbers that they said in the whole world in from December, we'll say, to March, in was 4,291 out of a population in the world of 7 million.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's in the whole world over 4 months. So that works out at 56 people a day, and that's a chart from the CDC and the WHO. Now, every day, 150,000 people die every day in the world. Every day, 3,000 people die of TB, an infectious disease. 1,000 people die in the winter, you know, of influenza, right? So it was 56 people died every day. So in 4 months, it was 4,291. So the next question, if I was prime minister or if I was advising the governments, is you'd say, well, how many people die every year from influenza in the world, right? In the north, okay? So in the we have it in the winter season. So in the world, every year, between 400,000 and 600,000 people die every year from influenza symptoms, influenza-like illness. So 4,000 is 1% of that. So if you're a prime minister and someone is coming and saying we want to lock down the country because we have this disease, then you would say, how many people die every year normally in the world? 400,000. How many people in four, you know, in the whole winter season from October to March? 4,000. You say 1%. That's not the same as a normal flu season. It's not half. It's not 1/10. It's not 1/20. It's 1/100. So if I was prime minister or in the WHO or, you know, wherever, the UN, anywhere, I would say, no, we are not. There is no need to take any measures. This is a fraction of what the normally people die at the almost at the end of the seasonal coronavirus. So that's why I can say there was
no need for lockdown.
And, you know, some of the models from the UK, they were predicting that what happened in the whole world in 4 months would happen in one country in the UK at every day. And of course, Professor Gupta came out immediately and refuted it. But just you don't need to have any degrees. And the analogy I used on another interview was it would be like if the uranium industry or radioactivity industry says we've got this huge issue, we have to close down the world. And then you say, well, what is background radiation and what's the issue here? And they say it's 1% of background radiation. You just say, no, there's no point. You know, this is we don't need to do this. Just common sense. And so that's why I'd want everyone to look up the 11th of March, 2020, the WHO declaration. So it was no necessity from day one and anyone with common sense. And that's why I've been discussing about accountability, because every prime minister in every country that locked down, it's a common sense thing. They don't need to pretend they're relying on anyone. And then we have to take a good hard look at the World Health Organization. Because there's huge consequences for locking down And Professor Raoul has showed that it's actually the deaths were associated with the lockdown, because a lot of the elderly in the care homes, you know, people, they were not cared for the same way because people were frightened. You know, people might have left. So the deaths are associated with the lockdown. And he showed that the huge spike in deaths in the care homes was related to the day different countries locked down, not in a seasonal way as would happen normally. So there was no reason for the lockdown on day one. And that's why I think, you know, obviously I'm president now of the World Freedom Alliance, and I would see this as an alternative to the United Nations. And we're going to set up an international regulatory body that will be an alternative to the WHO. And this year in 2020, we are aiming to set up an international criminal tribunal, because currently the World Health Organization has an indemnity if they declare a lockdown. But this is actually about the eighth lockdown. So I've been aware since SARS-1, 2002-03, that they've been declaring pandemics, you know, or calling, you know, huge issues about death. But the first SARS was death of 1 in 8 million, right? Your chances of dying of cardiovascular disease is 1 in 3 in Ireland,
that's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying, is it's very simple. It will come out eventually. There was no need. And every day the prime ministers and people require people to wear masks and quarantine, they as individuals can be held to account. Because there are crimes called malfeasance and malfeasance in public office. And these you can, you know, individuals can take them against individuals. You don't need to go to the police, and you do it under notice of liability. And I have been doing this in Ireland and in the UK now and around the world, because doctors and science advisors and prime ministers cannot actually be making policy decisions when there is clear evidence. Everybody knew that there was no need. And there was people like the Nobel Prize winner, Professor Michael Levitt, was putting real data in January. No need for modeling. He said in January, the peak in China will be in February. It will be a precipitous drop in March. He was correct. And he forecast that. And you could do real data. Now we have real world and data. People know exactly how many people are in the hospitals, how many people are in ICU. In Ireland, zero people in January, February, and all of March died from COVID-19. The prime ministers of Ireland and the health minister knew that in real time. There was no reason in Ireland for the lockdown or in the UK, because there was zero deaths from COVID-19. And the last thing I'll say before you jump in again, Richie, is to say that Ireland has 5 million people, zero deaths. The first death was from COVID-19 is in April. We have about up until September, 2nd of September, in the whole country, we had 100 deaths. Every single one of those deaths are preventable if they got the right treatment. So there should be zero deaths, really, right? So there is no need to lock down the country. And we have had the lowest number of total deaths, because if there was this new disease, there should be more deaths than every other year. And up till the end of July in Ireland, we have had the lowest total number of deaths of the last 10 years. So there is no increase in death. So now you have to say, constantly saying, what's going on?
What's going on,
Who is making these decisions? And they need to stop.
Let me jump
in. And they need to help to account.
Let me jump in. When, in recent weeks and months, I've interviewed Professor Sucharit Bhakti from Germany. I've had Martin Kulldorff on here. I could name them all day long. You were on here today, thank God. So you're
and
here.
And
Vernon. I've had all these people. And
thank you, Richie.
Not at all. No, listen, you've very eloquently, all of you, explained, using statistics that are easy for anybody to find, why you believe
CSO.
The lockdown.
CSO.ie. CSO.ie, quarter one. Everyone can Google World Health Organization pandemic declaration, the 11th of March, 2020.
It's all there. Yeah.
But
I'm gonna put a word in for Boris Johnson. It kills me. It pains me to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. While you were doing that, and you're all eminent scientists with great credentials and qualifications, and you are, I believe, as honest as the day is long. That's what I believe. There's nothing in it for you. You know, there's nothing in it for you other than grief.
Oh, no, I'm losing my income, and I've actually spent about 20,000 because I'm afraid to ask for donations, because then the media will...
They'll hammer you. Yeah.
You know, slate me. So I've actually paid for the screens in Trafalgar, you know, on a number of occasions, even though the police confiscated them, and I funded all my own trips around the world. not around the world, but just in Europe, because I'm trying to bring doctors together and I'm fighting court cases. So no, it's bankrupting me, basically. I don't mind. And of course, you know, in my work, they had meetings of the whole faculty, unprecedented, to try and disadvantage me, you know.
At UCD, at the university.
And written to newspapers to say that they are, you know, supporting the government lockdown while I have free speech.
So, what happened to...
And I was a private person. Obviously, I had no social media accounts as well before this. So
wow.
It's hugely damaging.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Dolores. And when I say that, I mean it. I'm dreadfully sorry to
hear.
I
know you do.
Yeah, I do mean it.
But I'm just saying that, you know, and of course, very, very few of my family or friends personally would be of the same opinion as well. But, you know, so it's tricky, you know.
When I mention you, I'm out and about in Salford. And, Asher, look, I'm well known. I'm well known as the guy who presents this programme in Salford. And I meet people who... They don't agree with anything that I say, and they buy the government line. So I'll always mention you. I'll mention a handful of people I've interviewed and people I haven't interviewed, even like yourself, who I hadn't spoken to until today. And I would say, well, look at what Professor Dolores Cahill is doing and others. And they always say to me, and this is where I'll put a word in for Johnson and for Hancock, as detestable as he is. They will say, Richie, there's nearly 36 members of the SAGE committee. They're Imperial College London. They're Oxford University. They're all over the place. Every time I turn on GMTV and watch Piers Morgan, every time I turn on Sky News, I see loads of GPs. I see loads of epidemiologists. They're all saying COVID is a killer. The lockdown is necessary. To put in a word for Johnson, I'd love to see him arrested and ask questions as well. But maybe Johnson is a politician, no more, no less. And with that weight, and I did have Desmond Swain MP on the programme the other day, and I said to Desmond Swain, why is Johnson not listening to the hundreds and thousands of great Barrington scientists and people like yourself? And Desmond Swain gave Johnson a pass, and he said, look, he's got all of these people around him. They're government appointed. They've got the letters after their name as well. And they tell him COVID is deadly, the lockdown is necessary. He's got no choice. That's what they say. What else can he do? Only go along with what they recommend. So what do you say to that?
I am afraid I would say, I'll just give you one other example, right? So, you know, the lockdown, right? If you have the lockdown, you have to say, what are the consequences of the lockdown? So yeah. Boris Johnson, and in Ireland, we had Dr. Leo Varadkar, and we have Micheál Martin, for example, right? They made a decision on the lockdown. And this is all really common sense for everyone. You don't need to go, you know, don't need any kind of expertise. You would say, what is the harm of the lockdown versus the harm of this disease, COVID-19? Very simply, right? And I would say, if Boris Johnson or anyone is standing for election as a leader, right, Boris Johnson, the weight of a decision like that is on his personal shoulders. And if he is fobbing it off to experts and committees, then he's in the wrong job. He should step down. So that is the thing about malfeasance, right? Is that if you are a leader and you stand for election, you have a duty of care to the people that elected you. And more generally, there is a bond between politicians who are elected and the people who pay their salaries, you know, and there is a democratic process. And also the people that are on these committees and the civil service and the members of parliament, there is a bond, a duty of care that they try and do the right thing and first do no harm, right? Whether you're a politician or not. But also they are getting paid salaries and their pensions, and they have a high status, including the doctors and scientists on these committees. And so they have to actually weigh the evidence and say, is this doing more harm than good? So I've just said in Ireland, we had, we'll say, in the first 8 months in Ireland, 20,000 people died, you know, between January and September.
Yeah.
100 people died from COVID-19. Okay, that is now clearly, okay, in Ireland. So then you have to say, what is the harm of the lockdown? And of course, there's like 70 years of evidence that if you do something that causes a contraction in the economy, and we can study it from the Great Depression or banking crises, that you get, you know, increase in unemployment. So let's take Ireland. Ireland went from 5% unemployment to 20% unemployment, okay, by May 2020, one of the worst affected in the European Union. So there was a study that is well known in Switzerland that says that for 3 months of the lockdown in Switzerland, which has a better society than Ireland, every single person alive in Switzerland, their lives will be shortened because of the lockdown by 3 months. So we've had 6 months, we'll say now, of the lockdown. That means that the harm of the lockdown is clearly known, is 6 months, every single person. So if you look at that in Ireland, there's 5 million people. That means in the 6 months of the lockdown, the people alive in Ireland now have lost 2.5 million years of life on average. In the United Kingdom, if you have 66 million people, you have lost 33 million years of life from the lockdown, which is, you know, not diagnosis, increase in unemployment causes cardiovascular disease, stress, depression, suicide, right? So Boris Johnson, or we'll say Leo Varadkar, 2.5 million years of life lost versus 100 COVID-19 deaths up to September, but all of them were preventable. That he as a leader has the duty, it is on his shoulders, it is a decision, he can't fob it off. And every single day in the United Kingdom and in Ireland, people's lives are being shortened. And he cannot fob it off to anyone else. So I would say no. And then I just might say that there is additional harm that are not in those things, which is for measures like the masks. You know, the masks, which is unprecedented.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you have a disease that people can be prevented and no one need die, right? You have to then take, say, what is the harm of the masks? And the harm of the masks is it reduces your oxygen supply within a few minutes. It increases carbon dioxide to literally, there are OSHA standards in America that above 2000, if you were a worker, you could not work in that. It's so poisonous. And after a minute or so, people's carbon dioxide goes up to 5,000, 6,000, right, when they're breathing, which essentially is against health and safety. So, you know, the harm of the masks, right, which will be an additional harm to like the 30 million years of life lost in the United Kingdom because of Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock, right, for a disease that is preventable. So the harm of the masks, in addition, is that I've been working with an absolute expert, Manuel Düring, who used to be a regulator for uranium facilities, you know, radioactivity facilities.
Yeah.
And I ran one of these biosafety labs. So, of course, we are there as employers, you know, even though I worked in the Max Planck for 8 years, if you take the personal responsibility to run a biosafety lab and the same as to sign off in a uranium facility, we are
Right, Dolores has just frozen on me there just a little bit. You're listening to Professor Dolores Cahill, who's live on the programme this afternoon, this evening, talking about why she's convinced that there was no need for any lockdown. There should never have been a lockdown. Dolores, we lost you momentarily there, but I think you're back in the room. Yeah, the picture just froze. We are radio.
Take home message, Richie, is I just want to go about masks, but it is that you have to do a harm-benefit analysis in everything, right? What is the harm of the disease COVID-19? Is there a prevention and treatment? What is the harm of the lockdown versus the benefit? What is the harm of the mask? It's very common
sense. And you're saying, right, that there's no excuse for Boris Johnson or Leo Varadkar or any other prime minister to not do the harm versus benefit analysis.
Yeah, it was obvious. But I think I'd just like to say there is additional harm in this lockdown. Because, you know, if you had the 1930s recession, there was a clear increase in unemployment, and that was, you know, you could see the increase,
mental
the reduction
health,
in everybody's life expectancy, right?
Yeah.
But of course, the people who suffer most are the people who have mental health issues. They may not have had them before, and that is because of the isolation and the loneliness, okay? So those people, on average, 2% of each population will have actually 10 years of average, the people who have mental health, right? So it's actually enormous. But the additional harm, we are doing an experiment on society, which is shocking, is the masks. So there is health and safety in Germany as well. There is legal, you know, if you're a scientist, there's actually, it's one of the countries where if you cause harm or you do misreporting or there are criminal consequences, you know, including for publishing papers that may be fraudulent. That the masks, there are standards that after 2 hours, so if you were working in a laboratory wearing a mask, after 2 hours, you have to take a half an hour break. and the mask has to be exactly specified. And then you may only, we say, wear the mask for 6 hours, okay? But you can only do that for 3 days, and then you have to take 4 days off. So Manuel Döring and his legal team had a court case to say that no government can just tell people to wear masks. They have to say what are the rest periods for the masks and the dangers. And he won that case, and I was very happy to be associated with it as president of the World Freedom Alliance and the World Doctors Alliance to come over and support him and communicate that message. But the press release about the court case, so the court case meant that wearing masks in Dusseldorf was deemed illegal because the governments had not actually put in the health and safety criteria. So that meant that all employers and all, we'll say, principals and teachers were actually legally responsible for the harm. But the harm that he proved was that you get permanent reversible brain damage after 2 hours wearing a mask.
Yeah, yeah.
Permanent. And that you can actually, you know, claim. And so we are requiring masks for teenagers who are not affected in the world. There is no healthy person, right? But they are getting permanent brain damage.
Permanent brain damage. Again, Dolores is freezing on me there. I think it's because she's got her camera on. Yeah, I think it's because she's got her camera on. And we have gotten into this, of course, with Dr. Vernon Coleman, who has got a book that he's just published called Proof That Face Masks Do More Harm Than Good. And in that book, he echoes everything you've just heard Dolores say there about masks and oxygen depletion and how even wearing the mask for a short period of time can do irreversible brain damage, can kill cells, can kill brain cells.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dolores, we just lost you just for a minute. I'm also bearing in mind that we've got about 10 or 11 minutes left today.
Well, can I just finish off?
Of course you can. I'm not going to interrupt you.
And then I'll finish off. I mean, 1 second.
Go ahead.
Is that when we did the press conference, we got 13 million downloads of the press release in 6 hours.
Astonishing.
And in 5 days, we got 1.1 billion downloads. 1,100 million.
And you never got, and you never got a mention. You never got a mention in the Irish or the British press.
No. So the thing is, there's huge appetite for that, and of course, this is a pushback on the media and the censorship. So, but we won the court case that masks cause more harm than good. So everyone, you know, if you think you're doing good for your children, you're actually permanently. And I have never worn a mask through all this. I will not wear a mask, and I have not been tracked and traced. You know.
Yeah.
So we just need to push back.
You're right, I don't wear a mask either. I said to my listeners, I'm not in the habit of telling my listeners what to do. But I said, if you download the NHS app, you're an idiot. You know, don't download it. Don't wear a mask. You're an idiot. It's going to harm you. And
you know, I was detained by the police, as you know, in the airport, because I think we have to take a stand. It is unlawful. We have freedom of travel, right? And we have freedom of speech. We have inalienable rights. We have privacy. So there is no, you see, that's why it's very important to go back to the underlying premise. Was the pandemic declaration necessary? No. Is there prevention and treatment that means no one need die? Yes. Then we now have to take off the COVID-19 glasses and look at what's going on. And I'm saying that what's going on now is tyranny, that the government are trying to tell you how many people can go into your home, whether you can practice your religion, whether you have to locked into your home for no reason.
And vaccines.
So this is just tyranny. And I'm afraid the police are acting unlawfully. The politicians, there's no justification for it. This is, you know, they are trying to undermine society and the bonds within families and the bonds within people. And there is no reason for it.
And there's no reason for it. And let's come now, because we're exactly 14 minutes to the top of the hour. Professor Dolores Cahill is on the line. We've got another 10 or 11 minutes left, so let's spend that time talking about the news last week that Pfizer and BioNTech have an RNA vaccine. News yesterday that Moderna has got an RNA vaccine, and we're being told that we need to keep these lockdown measures until the vaccine. And Matt Hancock said yesterday, until the science can keep us safe. They've stated that they want every man, woman and child on the planet eventually to have one of these vaccines. What do you think? What do you say?
Well, I say now, this is all of that I'm saying today, by the way, is just Dolores Cahill, right? It's not in any of my other roles, you know. But I would just say, well, so really, you know, what's going on? Governments are spending money, right? So PCR testing is spending money. these vaccines are essentially products, and there's, I think, over 50 different vaccines, okay? And people make 70% of the pharmaceutical industry profit now comes from vaccines. So the first question you have to ask is the vaccine necessary? So if you have last year's flu, which everybody was immune in April, the whole world, and in America, out of 350 million people, you had, like, for some weeks, 6 people gone to hospital after May for influenza-like illness, okay? Therefore, and everyone, these coronaviruses are seasonal. So essentially, it's like last year's flu. Is there a requirement to do a medical intervention for a seasonal flu that in Ireland, 100 people died, but no one need die, but everyone else in Ireland, everyone is exposed to these viruses in about a month in every region around February, March, April. So there is no basis for it. So then you have to say any money that the government spends for something that is not necessary needs to be looked at from a budget oversight committee, right? I'm just saying this is the government are saying something is necessary, but I am saying it's not. And also the PCR tests are not necessary, right? Because essentially after May, in the Northern Hemisphere, people are not dying from COVID-19. They're dying from something else. So there's no need. A lot of the PCR testing case numbers and vaccines are almost like a distraction, you know, a false argument. So if there was no need for the lockdown, if the whole world are immune, so really, like in Ireland, if you're under 65, it's 8 people under 65 died from COVID-19 in the first 8 months. So that's a risk of dying of 1.5 million. But of course, if you got prevention and treatment, no one would die. So that's around the same risk of SARS, you know, 8 years ago or whatever, 17 years ago. But like 1 in 3 people will die of cancer. 1 in 3 people will die of cardiovascular disease. And 1 in 3 people will die of everything else. So there is no need for the vaccine. And Ireland is very good, just to finish off on that, because if there was a need for it, the government are falsely reporting numbers like around 1,800, right? But if there was 1,800, you'd have more deaths than the last 10 years, right? They are reporting it, which is false reporting, of 1,800 people, because they're actually people. It's like if you had the chickenpox, you know, 40 years ago, and they did a PCR test and you were chickenpox, and they were putting chickenpox down now. And that's like something you had, you're totally immune for life, right? So if there was this 1,800 that is on the CSO website, everyone can see it, you would expect to have 1,800 more deaths?
Yeah.
So it turns out up to July is the lowest number of deaths in total in the last 10 years. Therefore, there's no excess deaths. There was no need for the lockdown. They knew there was no extra people in the hospitals. So therefore, you have to say, if I was prime minister, I'd say, why you are trying to sell us? 54 companies are developing like 54 products, the PCR tests. You are trying to sell a product which actually we don't need for a disease that was last year. The whole world is immune. And anyway, we have prevention and treatment that are vitamins like vitamin D and C with Nobel Prizes, zinc, the safest in the world, one of the safest drugs. And the last thing I just say about hydroxychloroquine is that if they're saying that hydroxychloroquine is dangerous, then I would say, okay, let's review every pharmaceutical medicine that is for sale in the United Kingdom and Ireland. And if they have so paracetamol has more adverse events than hydroxychloroquine, right? So if they're saying hydroxychloroquine can't be used, then that means every drug that has higher adverse events, you know, more harm, should also not be used. We should just take a good hard look. The medicine and pharmaceutical industry, they can't have it every way. No. So I would clearly say, and I'm saying if you gave me, because there has been 0 vaccines licensed ever, right, for any coronavirus. There was a cold institute for 40 years to make a vaccine against the common cold. They tried for 40 years, no one, because, and the thing closed down without developing one vaccine. And there's been loads of trials. And the reason why they have not done is that in the animal models, the animals were so sick and died that not one vaccine for coronavirus was actually ever licensed.
Yeah, look this up.
And the reason is that the animals don't get sick after the vaccine. And that's why I spoke out. There could be okay after the vaccine, unless there was things in it like aluminium that are super toxic to the brain and cause autoimmune disease and huge adverse events, or nickel or cadmium or steel. So there's a lot of metals in the vaccines that shouldn't be there. But they don't die when you get the vaccine. They die when you have the next circulating coronavirus. And so why I came out in May was that the Irish Medicines Organization said in the middle of a coronavirus pandemic, so-called, which wasn't, but it was circulating, they were going to vaccinate people with influenza flu vaccine, which had been grown on dog tissue, which had coronavirus, which when it was given to healthy soldiers the year before as a first kind of a vaccine, one in three of those soldiers had adverse events. And the adverse events can be so severe that, you know, you in the animal studies, there are some ones where all the animals die. So you could have huge deaths. So I have said, if you gave me a million or 10 million or any amount of money, I wouldn't take that vaccine. And also if someone tried to vaccinate me, because in Victoria, Australia, they can break into your house, pin you down, forcibly vaccinate you, right? That I would actually sue someone for attempted murder.
Is that, because is you that will true, only know, Dolores?
And the symptoms, people won't die of influenza. It will be sepsis. So I just want to make people aware, sepsis is like if you get an infection. And it's also called cytokine storm, because you're super priming the body in the injection with coronaviruses, with RNA. It's actually lethal to the body, right? And the body then does the cytokine storm, super priming, and you can die very rapidly within 4 or 5 days. You go into organ failure with sepsis, with kidney failure. And so we will be monitoring if there are increases in deaths from the last, you know, for people who have had influenza vaccine. And it would be significant deaths. It could be thousands of deaths. So there is no need. And the other thing is, the regulators have said they're going to skip the safety studies, the animal studies. And the reason why they're doing it is, for decades, the animals are always very sick and die. So now for these vaccines that they're saying that they're developing now in November 2020, they've skipped the animal studies. Because, of course, if all the animals dies, these commercial products, they couldn't ask the governments. And so I think it should be stopped that the money is spent on these vaccines. And one last thing I want to say is that Dolores Cahill will be proposing to the World Freedom Alliance, the World Doctors Alliance, that we ask all the vaccine industries to submit the causative agent of COVID-19. If they have a vaccine for COVID-19, that I will lead up internationally a repository of what is causing COVID-19. Because if they have a PCR test for it, these companies making PCR tests and vaccines should know what the causative agent is, and we can hold it as a central repository to give it to people. Because if they've said the vaccine is working, the vaccine manufacturers also need to send the causative agent, because then we need to check, is it actually going? So we need a causative agent for the disease COVID-19.
Folks, if you want to find out more about what you've been listening to this evening, go to worlddoctorsalliance.com. That's worlddoctorsalliance.com.
And World Freedom Alliance as well, which will be like an alternative to the United Nations. So we've only been doing it. Dr. Heike Schoening from Germany is vice president. I was elected president. We have 45 countries. We will be bringing every single country in the world. It will be the opposite of the United Nations. It will be transparent and accountable. And I, Dolores Cahill, will also be proposing that we set up an international regulatory body, and that patients can interact with their medical condition practitioners on a notice of liability. So the doctor has to give you full informed consent. And if they don't, they can be held accountable. And like, you know, you could have, if a Nobel Prize winner, Michael Levitt, had a world organization, a platform that he could have discussed the data in real time in January and February, and people got that message through the media and the politicians and the civil service and, you know, the science advisory boards were properly open debate and academic freedom, we wouldn't have the lockdown.
Listen, I'd like to get you back on to talk more about that, particularly the World Freedom Alliance and what you plan
World
to do
Freedom
there.
Alliance. Yeah, World Freedom Alliance, yeah. I would love that. And of course, my little website is DoloresCahill.com.
I was going to mention that, DoloresCahill.com as well. I'll put links out to that where people can find that on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for giving us your time today, Professor Dolores Cahill.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. And to all your listeners and to all the people who are giving me good wishes. And I also just am saying that we need to re-engage with our families and be spiritual and with prayer in these times, because that helps remove the fear. And I'm trying to launch a campaign between now and Christmas, and that we need to stop this before Christmas. I will be saying there will be a rally in Dublin with the I'm chair of the Irish Freedom Party on November the 28th in the Customs House at 2 o'clock. And we really want everyone. So I'm saying home for Christmas, not just the people who are abroad, but the elderly in the care homes are not prisoners. And we need to reconnect as families and to realize that social distancing, not being able to have ceremonies like funerals, yeah. weddings, practice our religion. There's no need for quarantining. You know, we home for Christmas. We need to stop this.
You have the Irish.
Thank you anyway, Richie. That's all.
You're very welcome, Dolores. I hope we'll speak again soon. Thanks for that.
Oh, anytime, Richie. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. And to all your listeners, thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Dolores Cahill. It's DoloresCahill.com. WorldFreedomAlliance.com. I was just going to make the point. Jean Anne made the point to me earlier on, my mate Jean Anne, that the Irish government is actively engaged in asking Irish expats not to return home for Christmas. It's disgraceful. Let me give a big shout out to my friend Patricia Braunschweiler, a fantastic lady. I'd invited Dolores Cahill on the programme once or twice back in May. I think back in May, June. I never heard back. Didn't think anything of that. No harm, no foul. I imagine the woman was getting a lot of correspondence at the time, and I didn't pursue it again. And Patricia was determined that she would come on the programme. So I chased her up last week and got her to come on. So well done, Patricia. It's a cast of thousands sometimes here at the Richie Allen radio show. That's about it for today. There was something else to say, but it must be garbage. I can't think of it off the top of my head. Back tomorrow, and I'm going to introduce you to a gentleman who'll be live from California tomorrow called, we know him as Chef Kenner. He's got an extraordinary tale to tell, an extraordinary personal story. And in it, we're going to talk a little bit about the subject of lucid dreaming. So it's going to be a lovely, but also very interesting departure from all things coronavirus. I'll have a news roundup tomorrow for 30, 35 minutes as usual. And then we'll have a chat with Kenner. So it's going to be good. Thanks to Gilad Atzmon. Great guy. Top man. Thanks also to Professor Dolores Cahill. Thank you. I have been the Big Baldy Gammon. Speak tomorrow.